Sean. Matt just joined us as well.
Okay, thanks, Sergey.
Yeah, thanks, Sean.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Okay, let's convene the meeting. We have escorted to the virtual meeting. This will be our March the 22nd commission meeting, which will be virtual, and we're going forward. We're going to be virtual for some time. First item here is approval of the consent agenda.
No. Could I suggest that somebody's got a mic on that they're breathing real hard and that we mute unless you're speaking? Thanks. Go ahead, Will.
Okay. Consent agenda, which was sent out earlier. We've had a chance to have a look at it. Do I have a motion to approve that? Are there questions or comments?
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
I second.
And moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for March the 22nd, 2021. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Agenda revisions. Doug, do we have any?
Yeah, the only one we have, Will, is Bill can't make the time here, so John's going to present for Bill.
Thank you. All right, comments from the public. Before we get into that, we've got a pretty full agenda. So what we're going to do is limit comments with this resolution 2194-21. We'll limit comments per individual for 3 minutes, and then we'll overall public comment will be limited to 30 minutes. We're doing this a little different. There's a timer which will appear on your screen, and you'll get a warning at, with 1 minute left in comments, and then a final ding that will say, well, your time is up. You should conclude your thoughts, and so we can move on there. If that time constraint is a problem and people are not able to get in on making their comments, we will accept comments in writing. So, and I've already received a number of emails, both in support of the resolution and opposing. So, we can add that to it. And Sean, you're going to keep track of the timing, right?
Yeah, no problem. So, if anybody wants to make a comment, the easiest thing to do instead of everybody talking over each other, if you could just submit your first name in the chat. And I'm happy to call them in the order that I receive them. And for those of you that are on the phone, which it looks like there is one person, you can star 6 to unmute and give me your first name, and I'll add you to the list as well.
And, of course, those people can't see the timer, so we'll try to keep that straight, and you'll hear a ding when that timer is up. So.
Hey, Will, I have a question.
Okay, sure.
You said 30 minutes. 30 minutes in each of the public comment periods.
Yeah, that's the plan, yes.
Okay, see how that goes.
Okay, so the first commenter I have is Jim McIntyre. Go ahead, Jim. The floor is yours for 3 minutes.
You got to unmute, Jim.
You're muted, Jim. Sorry.
There we go. Okay.
That's a common thing, Joe.
It's the Zoom buttonology. I should know it by now. I'll keep my comments very short. I'm happy to support the passage of Commissioner's Resolution 2194-21. I think the resolution in the whereas clauses summarizes the issue quite nicely. The only thing I would add is the EIS that was undertaken and accomplished by the federal partners was a very comprehensive multi-agency EIS process. Way back when it was open for comments, I commented favorably on the ERS. So I would encourage the commissioners to pass this resolution today, and thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Sean, I'm not seeing the timer.
It's probably on your next screen over.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, thanks, Jim, for the comment.
The next person is Christine Stollard. Go ahead, Christine. You have 3 minutes.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment and support of resolution number 2194-21. There's a lot I would like to say, so I wrote it out so I could keep it to 3 minutes. My name is Christine Stollard. I'm a resident of Diamond Point and Clallam County PUD ratepayer. I recently retired from a 30-year career as a government and public affairs director for a public utility district that owns and operates a large hydropower project with two generating facilities on the main stem Columbia River. And I work for a small electric cooperative in Southern Oregon that is a full requirements BPA customer, and I've also worked as a consultant in the industry. I'm very familiar with energy issues and energy policy in the Pacific Northwest. I want to commend you for recognizing the role the Federal Columbia River Power System has played and will continue to play in environmental stewardship, low-carbon river transportation, clean renewable electricity generation, a giant backup battery for our other renewables, recreation, flood control, and irrigation, all the things that affect our lives, the economy, and the lifestyles of this place we call home. It's an incredible system. Can you tell I'm passionate about it? I urge you to pass this resolution to protect our low-cost, non-carbon sources of electricity to help us meet clean energy goals, maintain a reliable flow of electricity, keep rates affordable, and provide continued funding for existing and new programs for fish and wildlife protection. This is significant and something many people don't realize. Between 2005 and 2015 alone, $757 million was invested by BPA in fish and wildlife programs. That's just BPA, no other hydropower. Clallam PUD gets 87% of our electricity from BPA, which means we helped pay for that. Without these fish and wildlife costs, BPA's electricity rate to its Northwest public utility customers, including Clallam, would be about a third lower. Ratepayers have invested a lot. I'm not saying this to be critical, quite the opposite. I think what we have here is remarkable.
Excuse me just a minute. Sean, I'm still not seeing the counter, so you're going to have to control this, okay?
I got it.
I'm looking at it.
You have 30 seconds left.
Yep. Okay. So given all that, a desire to meet our clean energy goals, be good stewards of the environment, protect and enhance fish and wildlife populations, and meet the needs of the people of the region, it doesn't make sense we would consider, let alone advocate for, removing our assets. So on behalf of the people you serve, I thank you for taking action like this to protect the environment and the integrity of our system. And thank you for allowing me to comment today.
Thank you very much. Good comments. Who's
Thanks,
next?
Christine. The next person is Brian Grad. You have 3 minutes, Brian.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity to comment. I am opposed to this resolution. I think, Commissioner Persner, you yourself noted that it's rather inconsequential. Nothing is really going to come of it. But I'm also opposed to it because it is not representative of what the ratepayers in this region desire. We do like inexpensive electricity. However, continuing to support these dams, and by way of doing so with this resolution, we're guaranteeing that the ratepayers will pay for the cost of those dams. They are money losers. They cost over $40 million last year. The BPA is continuously paying to mitigate the salmon habitat to the tune of roughly 24% of their budget. And those costs are passed on. They're not necessarily considered surcharges, but that is a driver of rate increases. And I think Commissioner Pascal noted that when he was elected to this position, he was doing so because he wanted to maintain and ensure that we had the lowest rates of electricity possible. And this would be a contradiction of that promise. Furthermore, there are assertions made in this resolution which are flatly false. They fly in direct contradiction to the existing science. This may be hydroenergy in general, may be considered clean, but the methane that is stored in those reservoirs behind the dam certainly isn't, and they continue to emit methane gas into the atmosphere. And all of the objections that people have made to the breaching of these dams have been essentially addressed and contradicted in full. So I would urge the tabling of this resolution. I don't think it's going to do anything to advance the operational strategy goals of RPUD. And I would urge you to, once again, review the support that is being given to Congressman Mike Simpson of Idaho's plan for the Columbia River Basin and Eastern Washington in general. It certainly will have great benefits for all those involved. It will provide in-stream irrigation. It will reinvigorate the sport recreational fishing industry. And that's all I have to say about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Next.
Sorry, I was on mute. The next person is Paul Hansen.
Okay, Paul.
Okay, thank you. I'm Paul Hansen in Carlsbad. I thank you for the opportunity to comment on this resolution 2194-21. As a citizen of Cole County and a PUD ratepayer and customer, I object to the PUD taking a political stand on my behalf. The question of breaching these dams is highly controversial, and there are many PUD ratepayers who believe that the removal of the dam is necessary to prevent extinction of some species of Snake River salmonoid and the consequent extinction of the southern resident orca pods. There is considerable scientific evidence supporting the view and also compelling evidence that the dams are not vital to the power, Northwest power generation, and in fact cost more to operate than they produce. I respectively submit that it is inappropriate for the Column PUD as a nonpartisan public utility to take a stand on this issue. Please oppose or remove this resolution from the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, and next is Ron Richards.
Okay, I don't have too much to say other than I'd like to sort of summarize my remarks by referring to the second speaker, the lady from Diamond Point. I followed this issue since the dams were put in. I grew up in Richland, Washington. I've been going to meetings on this issue for 20 or 30 years, and her comments might as well have been written 30 years ago. I've been hearing that same stuff forever, and it simply wasn't true 30 years ago, and it's definitely not true now. Things have changed. You know, California used to need our power. They don't anymore. As we speak, California's getting 75% of its energy from wind and solar. There's portions of California where the price of energy is negative at this moment, as much as $56 per megawatt. It's just insane to ignore changing times. And aside from the fact that, you know, energy, wind energy, solar, and batteries have just totally changed the landscape and affected the costs here and made these dams money losers, there's another huge cost here, and it's to Clallam County in the costs of tourism, recreation, retirement, things that the salmon used to contribute to a lot. Now, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you could not park between Clallam Bay and CQ because the whole road was taken up with boats and trailers. Same with Eddis Hook. If you wanted to launch out on the hook, you had to get out there about 3 a.m. This is all big cuts for our tourist economy. And this is something that the PUD needs to consider. They shouldn't just look at this in their own little shell. They need to look at the impact on the county. We're perhaps the most impacted counties, Jefferson and Clallam especially, in the whole state from these dams, because this is where, you know, our ocean seaports used to be such a draw. And nobody else has been impacted by these dams more than we have because of the decimated salmon runs that they've caused. So that's it, folks. I hope you vote against this resolution, but I don't expect it.
Thank you, Ron.
Next is Steve Kern.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I appreciate, my name is Steve Kern. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on resolution 2194-21. And I'm really putting forward this comments as a way to push the concern that I have, given my 40 years plus experience working in the power supply industry and especially working in power supply and operations. I see all the dialogue across the region and concerns over these projects, but I think one thing we can all agree upon is that we all want the lights to stay on. And unfortunately, unless you've sat in positions like I have, or even Commissioner Pascal has, you don't really understand the hourly operation of the federal system, how it dispatches to meet load in the Northwest, and also how much power still goes to California to support the integration of renewable resources on any hour. For example, last hour, 6,000 megawatts of generation went into California, helping reshape their renewable solar and wind generation. So going back almost 10 years ago, I raised concerns about the reliability of the Northwest, as at that point we were coming out of the 2008 economic downturn. And loads were starting to turn around, and there was a lot of discussion about reducing and or eliminating coal-fired power plants. But we've reached that point now. And the Northwest is, I believe, in a very concerning situation as it relates to capacity today. And I see the utilities are struggling with that, especially the larger utilities that have control areas and dispatch their generation separately. And I think they're struggling. The resource adequacy forum that's been set up trying to decide how to define adequacy has been underway for at least the last couple of years. And I think it's important people out there can go and look at some of the technical studies that are out there that show this concern. The Power Planning Council has released a study. It's public. PNUCC has released a study. And also PGP has done a series of studies on the resource adequacy in the Northwest. And looking at just most recent example, the cold weather that came through in February, it's a good test of the system to say what would have happened if we wouldn't have had currently 3,000 megawatts of Snake River generation per hour, which it was operating at the time. Our loads were down several thousand megawatts because of COVID. If we didn't have COVID, we would have seen an additional 2,000 to 5,000 megawatts of retail load on the system. And, you know, at that point in time, natural gas was in short supply. People were struggling to find natural gas. And yet hourly markets went to $300 to $400 a megawatt hour. At those prices, the Snake River generation had a value of $1 million an hour. So my point is that we need capacity today. We need to really understand reliability first. And I appreciate the opportunity to provide these comments.
Thanks, Steve. Good comments.
Next is Janet Marks.
Janet?
Got it, right?
There we go.
Okay. Okay. I am speaking for PowerShift. It's a group working for the local tax ratepayers. We expect the commissioners are doing the same. However, the following are our comments regarding this resolution. Number one, the resolution does not represent the Clallam PUD ratepayers, whose opinions on this issue are varied. Two, The breaching of the Lower Snake River dams has become a very public and political subject, involving state and national debates. The involvement of regional governors, legislators, tribal coalitions, and numerous special interest groups. This issue has also resulted in a legal complaint and a pending lawsuit. RPUD should, by not signing this resolution, avoid being involved in making decisions on political and unresolved actions. The timing of your resolution is a particular concern due to Representative Simpson's proposal, which has a bipartisan support. And number three, to date, with the exception of Commissioner Waddell, you have avoided publicly, and when I say you, I mean the commissioners, have avoided publicly discussing and debating the pro and con issues. We see no indication that you have a detailed understanding of this complex debate. It also appears the PUD management staff have provided this resolution without independently and thoroughly researching both sides of the issue. Without extensive due diligence, you are proposing signing a resolution based on an under-researched decision. For these reasons, PowerShift is opposed to your signing any resolution, either pro or con, on the Lower Snake River dams. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Will, I don't have any other commenters in the chat. If anybody wants to make a comment, will you go ahead and put it in the chat now? If you're on the phone, you can star 6 to unmute and give me your name, too.
Sean Richard here.
Okay. Go ahead, Richard.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity to comment. About 2 years ago, I passed around a paper introducing a futurist by the name of Tony Seba, who discussed clean disruption and the collapse of oil and coal industries. He referred to it as a technology disruption. He is a co-founder of a think tank called Rethink. He recently has reappeared and says that he was a little bit off in his prediction that the solar industry and the battery industry is actually advancing at a more rapid rate than he had thought. He predicts now that solar will continue to decrease at the rate of 20% per year in cost, and batteries will decline at the rate of about 15% per year. And he further states that the decade of 2020 is going to be the most disruptive in energy generation in the history of the world. As we speak, there is a 450-acre processing plant facility being developed near Phoenix, Arizona, that will produce heavy haul, all electric trucks, manufacturing the batteries for those trucks. So, gentlemen, the future of the battery is happening at an alarming rate. Along with this, the need for to replace turbines on the Lower Snake River dams is an issue that must be considered. The production of energy from those dams at a time when the demand is low should be considered. And furthermore, they cannot compete with solar today. At this very moment, solar is the cheapest source of energy out there. Project that forward 5 years. Do the math. And what do you come up with? I think we need to give some real deep thought to this and consider not supporting those dams. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Richard. Sam Woods.
Sam, you may be muted. Is he on, Sean?
I see him on. He's muted, though.
How about now?
Yep.
That's good.
You're muted again, Sam.
You're still muted, Sam. Sam, if you're talking, we can't hear you. Well, who's next in line, Sean?
That was it, Will.
Well, Sam, are you're muted and we can't hear you if you're talking.
How about now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have a couple questions for Mr. Parscale.
Let me just interject there. Sam, let me. You can make comments, but we're not going to engage in answering questions.
Okay. At this time, why must Clallam County PUD take a position on the Lower Snake River dams without public input? As you know, there's been major developments in the future of these dams with Senator Simpson's Columbia River Master Fund plan. I find it hard to believe that this rush to speak for all Clallam County ratepayers, having not presented them with all the options. I'm very concerned that this is just another case of the PUD commissioners having their noses too far up the power industry lobbyists' behinds to see the light of other options. There have been some titanic blunders over the course of time by PUD commissioners when they blindly follow what's told to them by these lobby groups. We don't have to go into the whoops fiasco cost or how much the freewheeling. I just want to say that the ratepayers need to have a word in this, and if you want to take a stand on this, I think the least you can do is have more public input and lay out all the options instead of the ones that are put forward by all these people that are in the industry. I'm beginning to believe that we need PUD commissioners at large that aren't in the industry so that they can actually see different opportunities that come up. Another thing is I would like to see the BPA and the Corps of Engineers spend money saving salmon instead of just wasting money and not getting the job done. And that's what's happening right now. These salmon are in a dire position, as are the southern orcas. And, you know, Simpson's plan replaces all the generation lost with these river dams. And I just don't see you as giving anyone options or even considering other options. That's disturbing to me. And also, you're not answering any questions at this time. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, Sean Hallberg.
I would like to speak out against the resolution. It seems like the commissioners as a whole are in favor of responding, sending in something, and I think that they should do that as individuals, but I don't think that they necessarily represent the ratepayers of the county, and I don't want them to be representing me with that resolution. That's the end of my comments.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're about out of time.
That was the last one, Will.
Interesting comments. and anyway, good conversation. All right, so We'll move on to business items. The first business item is Resolution 2194-21, supporting the Federal Columbia River Power System, recognizing its role in environmental stewardship, and opposing the removal of the Lower Snake River dams. Doug, you're going to cue that up?
Yeah, thanks, Will. Good afternoon, everybody. Very good comments, interesting comments. Appreciate them. Last meeting, we were asked by the staff and I were asked by the commissioners, two of the commissioners, to put together a resolution in supporting the Snake River dams. And that's what we've done. And so I want to go through a little bit what that was based on and why we did what we did. Well, first of all, the resolution mainly based on two documents, the EIS and CETA. And I'll go over a little bit what they are. The EIS, the Columbia River System Operation Environmental Impact Statement, EIS, was submitted by the Army Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and Bonneville Power Administration. These are the organizations and people that have firsthand expertise that operate and maintain the dams. They know the numbers. They work with them every day. The Corps and the Reclamation actually planned and designed, constructed, and own these and operate these dams. They're very knowledgeable about what they've put together. BPA markets the power generated and distributes through the transmission system. These are experts. They're good people, many of them living in Washington. After 4 years of study, the record of decision makes the federal agencies the preferred option in the EIS official. So I think it was last September where it became official. The EIS says it will benefit the salmon, reliable hydropower, and the economy. And that's still the record of decision today. It hasn't been thrown out. It's still the record of decision today. And let me quote here from the EIS here. The executive summary of the EIS says more than 30 entities from across the region, consisting of tribes, intertribal organizations, federal agencies, and state and local governments, agreed to participate as cooperating agencies in this NEPA process. We greatly appreciate their technical expertise and input on this document. We are especially grateful to our tribal partners for helping ensure that the document reflects tribal perspectives on the Columbia River system. Again, this is still the record of decision today. So that's based on the EIS. If you go through the resolution, you'll see where we indicate information about the EIS. The second one I mentioned was the Washington Clean Energy Transformation Act, CETA, which is in the news and a lot going on now. And in CETA, what it does is it sets milestones to reach 100% clean electrical supply. In 2021, this year, we have to put together a program for low-income program. We have to put together a low-income program. In 2022, we have to publish our own plan, the Clean Energy Implementation Plan, it's called. In 2025, we have to eliminate all coal-fired electricity from the portfolio. In 2030, the greenhouse gas has to be greenhouse gas neutral. In 2045, 100% renewable energy, and this fortunately includes hydro. So we do have a plan to go 100% renewable. It is out there. Another factor that we didn't mention in the resolution, but is a factor, is that BPA, Bonneville, is looking at joining the energy imbalance market. And it looks like they might be a member in 2022. And this is real-time energy market, automatically finding low-cost energy to serve real-time customers. BPA would sell surplus energy and capacity in the Western markets, helping to keep the rates lower. Clean hydro will be in high demand. Now, I've heard a couple of comments about political there. And I think the last thing we can say is that this resolution is political. It was based on facts, facts in EIS and facts in the future of CEDA requirements for us. The political solution is to throw billions of dollars at it and disrupt Eastern Washington and hope it all goes away, even though no one can guarantee it would save the Chinook salmon. There are many things that impact salmon recovery, and you all know that. They include unknown issues out in the ocean, not yet studied. That's become more and more important and talked about. It involves pollution. It involves global warming. It involves increasing the number of predators that are out there. And this goes on and on and on. It's not just removing the Snake River dams. Maybe efforts in those areas, those other areas, might have more of an impact. Removing the dams is not a guaranteed solution, and at a tremendous cost and disruption to Eastern Washington. We keep hearing, I keep getting and emails and all about that we're in a climate crisis. Well, if we're in a climate crisis, taking out clean renewables is not the answer. Now, we're very fortunate here at Clallam PUD. We've joined other good intelligence stakeholders. We have Washington State members that live here and love the environment, neighbors of ours, experts in energy, and organizations such as WPUDA, Washington PUD Association, PPC, BPA, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, and 22 plus, I'm not sure the exact number, but there's at least 22 PUDs that have all signed on to support Snake River dams. They're not all evil and bad people. They're not your enemies. Many of them are experts in these issues, and I think we should realize that. The call we received from Steve Kearns, he was the general manager down at Cowlitz PUD, and he's very knowledgeable. As he mentioned, he's been involved in this in the past. We should respect some of the information of our experts and not constantly fight among ourselves. And the last thing that I want to mention is that Clallam PUD needs to get back to our core business. Although Clallam PUD will not sway any decision to keep or remove the Lower Snake River dams, we need an official position on the Snake River dams. This has been a distraction over the last year and a half. We're spending too much time on it. Our staff needs to get back to our core business. We have a lot of work to do. There's much going on. COVID, over a year now, we're watching and keeping our employees and the public safe. We're concerned about that. We have a moratorium right now on disconnects, and the increasing amount of arrearages continues. And that goes on so far, the moratorium, to July 31st, and we know that it most likely will go longer. And that's impacting your PUD. We're getting ready for the CEDA requirements, which I mentioned earlier. That's a big effort that our people are working on. We have to catch up on projects postponed because of the COVID. For a while there, we had a number of the projects couldn't go forward, and we postponed them to future years. So we have to be working on that. We've got BPA. Post 2028 contract. We're working on the contract for BPA, and just normal everyday work. Therefore, our resolution resolves that removal of the elements of the FCRPS, including the Lower Snake River dams, without firm capacity replacement, would negatively affect the district's ability to provide reliable, efficient, clean, and affordable power to its customers. That the district supports retaining the four Lower Snake River dams for the lower carbon equivalent, renewable, reliable, low-cost energy they provide, making them an important component of a clean energy future. That the district opposes the removal or breaching of the four Lower Snake River dams, given uncertainty and the political negative impacts to long-term regional resource adequacy that was brought up in some of the comments. as well as the loss of other benefits as referred or as referenced in the EIS. Therefore, the staff recommends that the Commission pass Resolution 2194-21. Thank you. That's it, Will.
Thank you, Doug. Yeah, just to reaffirm some of that, it's kind of, it's amusing to me. I'm sorry if I showed my amusement that we commissioners were not informed on the issues, didn't know anything about resource adequacy or capacity markets or the EIM and so on. We were just kind of, I don't know what you guys think we do, but anyway, we're deeply immersed in this. We have been to going to meetings where it's been one of the topics, if not the main topic, for the last 3 or 4 years. So we certainly understand the issue. So anyway, and resource adequacy is a big, major thing. And the gentleman had talked about times of change. Yeah, he's right. Times have changed. And the biggest change we're facing is CETA, the Clean Energy Transition Act. If we're going to go to all renewables, and hydro is a renewable under that act, then it's not a time to be taking out dams. So anyway, other comments from the commissioners? Or
yeah, Will, I have some. Doug, you said 22 other PUDs have signed resolutions to support these dams. How many PUDs and co-ops are in the BPA authority area?
I'm sorry, what's that, Will?
How many PUDs and co-ops are in the BPA authority area?
Well, I'm talking about PUDs. They're all in the all the PUDs that signed are in the BPA area.
What I'm asking is how many total PUDs?
How many other PUDs? There's a total of about 26, 27.
So not all the PUDs signed this.
Well, I think so that's an overwhelming majority.
Water PUDs that haven't signed. And then there's a couple. I think Jefferson, I believe, is the only one that has made a decision not to sign it.
All right, thanks. Okay, so listen, what I'd like to do is address the resolution itself in a more rigorous or point-by-point way. And so, Sean, I'd like to share my screen for a minute, if I may.
You bet. You should be able to now, Jim.
Okay. It's always fun trying to figure out which document. Here we go. There it is. Okay, so what I've tried to do here is I couldn't pull apart the resolution itself, and so what I've done is numbered the various whereas statements in the resolution. And the document that everyone is seeing now on the screen, I did provide to Doug. Maybe the commissioners have it by now. It was something I put together over the last few days. I should point out that everything that I'm saying here, and this is noted in the bottom, comes from the government sources, EISs, whatever. Anyway, let me start with the basic points that I want to make here is I don't question the first whereas. The second one dealing with the dams are a critical component of life in the economy of the Pacific Northwest. I think what I've said here is the LSRDs have a benefit-to-cost ratio well below one. It's 15 cents on the dollar. And this is done by an economic firm based on the core zone economic analysis. Breaching will yield 3,000 to 4,000 more jobs than the very few of the jobs that the dams bring in are lost. And the 3,000 to 4,000 more jobs will be gained in agriculture, tourism, fishing, the ancillary services, wineries, motels, environment and cultural resources that go along with all that. In terms of the next whereas where it deals with navigation, recreation, fish and wildlife, and so forth, I need to point out that the data shows that more than half the barge traffic has already shifted to rail over the last 20 years.
The remaining can easily shift to existing rail lines. 95% of all farmers will still truck their grain to the same elevators they are using now. Recreational benefits from free-flowing river are many times greater than with the current stagnant reservoirs, and irrigation benefits can be maintained at low cost. The next whereas dealing with our critical component of supporting peak power generation. This is a long-held myth, but basically the LSRDs provided virtually no peaking or reserve power. They are run-of-river dams severely constrained by seasonal flows and operational restrictions. And indeed, I sent you guys this morning just the issues going on at one of the dams in regarding transmission outages and what our transformer outages at one of the dams and what that impact was on turbine availability. Anyway, claimed peaking values in the 2020 EIS that you noted are theoretical. There is no generation data to support their use other than late night ramp down and back up in the morning to fall load and prices, since most is sold on secondary market. Okay, the next point I want to make has to do with the statement about the number of customers and so forth. You say a 500,000 customers. 500,000 customers is an exaggeration based on low usage rates. And the LSRDs can only do this for a couple months during spring high river flows. The dams may be carbon-free, but annual methane emissions from the reservoirs are equal to 87,000 metric tons of carbon. Again, there's another whereas dealing with peaking capacity, and I note that no peaking capability, neither the physics nor 15 years of generation data demonstrate noticeable peaking power. To attempt any sustained peaking would violate several longstanding quartered operational agreements and very, very quickly impair river navigation. Next point has to do with the value of the power, and this is a theoretical value that has not been proven by the Corps' data query 2.0 files. Also misleading in that these are not storage dams like Grand Coulee or Chief Joseph on the Columbia, both of which have significant peaking capabilities because they are storage dams instead of run-of-river dams. The next point deals with the clean energy and so forth. Again, they emit methane, 87,000 metric tons of carbon equivalent. And indeed, breaching would not only avoid methane emissions, but would free up 3,000 megawatts of grid space that would allow reasonably quick utilization of wind, solar with battery backup that is already or currently waiting interconnection on the BPA internet grid. They're on the queue right now. These renewables can replace fossil fuels at a much quicker rate and with a cheaper resources. We do not have to expand the grid to accommodate this. Indeed, energy resource models run by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council in the last few weeks are now showing this, along with a commensurate decrease in loss of load probability below 5% in 2 or 3 years. A couple of people have pointed out these resource adequacy studies over the last 2 years and so forth, and this was a real eye-opener for the council when they heard this week before last, because they'd been listening to this these statements about the
Yeah, can you hear us? We've lost you.
Well, it looks like he froze up.
Well, there's no audio either, so.
He must have lost connection. T, do you want to try to call him?
Call him or text him and see if he can get back on. Dee, did you hear that?
Yes, I did. I'm calling him now, Will.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, sorry. Oh, that might be him.
Sorry, guys. I had an error connect.
Okay, good.
Lost here. If I may continue. Anyway, I was pointing out that the amount of power actually going to California right now is being sold at zero. In other words, no money in spite of the cost of over $36 a megawatt
hour. Jim, do you want to put your document back up? We can't. We're not seeing that.
Yeah, thanks. I will do that. Okay. Sorry for the interruption. So let's see. And where was it? Okay, comment number nine deals with more another comment, Steve or something, and I point out again the amount of methane that's being produced frees up grid space. I won't repeat all that. The number 10 deals with the EIS that you pointed out, and I have to say that many groups have pointed out our many fatal flaws with the EIS. Any one or two of these flaws would certainly have the EIS voided by the court in the motions that are now underway. This has happened before. Many of these flaws are just common sense, and ratepayers should not wait for more court proceedings to recognize the economic losses the LSRDs are creating and that power rates will go up between 5 and 15% with the preferred alternative. This is shown actually in the EIS on table 3.132. And what I can do, I think, is actually show you that table since you may not be familiar with it because it's buried pretty deep in there. If I can figure out how to share this other document. Can you guys see that on my screen?
We just see the Word document.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm trying to share another chart, but I can't figure out. Oh, here we go. Is that showing up now?
Oh, your document went all blurry, and we're not seeing the chart.
Well, okay, I will keep messing with this, but basically this table from the EIS shows that with the MO3, which was the dam breaching alternative, which also had some additional expenses to it on spill, which I believe which is unnecessary really, but nevertheless, with all the cost of MO3, it showed that the percentage change in annual equivalent cost will drop by 15% with this with breaching. And so what this is telling us is over the long term that it's cheaper to breach the dams than it is to maintain them or to use any of the other alternatives. And I'd be glad to forward that chart along to you. Anyway. This is a common problem in the EIS, this EIS, as it was in the 2002 EIS. Information buried in thousands of pages indicates dam breaching to be the best biological and economic choice, but ignored in the summaries, which you read from Doug, conclusions in the record of decisions, which you also noted. The dams, the next point I want to make is about the cost. The dams are operating a loss about, and for the last several years, and about $40 to $50 million last year. This is based on FOIA requests for budget information from the Corps of Engineers that shows exactly how much was spent. They are most certainly not providing benefits to salmon now and will not under the preferred alternative. Both the 2002 and 2020 EIS point this out, but ignored both time and the conclusions. Because the LSRDs are failing economically and are not meeting environmental laws, they are not meeting their authorized purpose. And since an authorization is not a mandate, the Corps and BPA can immediately start breaching them without any kind of further authorization or deauthorization. The next point is similar. same comment, except that I will also add, as some noted, is the preferred alternative in the EIS will further eradicate salmon for tribes in both the Columbia Basin and the coastal areas. Tribes and other fishermen in western Washington will lose what few jobs are left of what was once an economic driver of Clallam County. So in the resolutions themselves, I would say that the BOC of this district should not support the continued operation of the LSRDs and should demand BPA stop wasting our ratepayers' money on them and apply those funds to the rest of the FCRPS. The second resolution should really reflect the FCRPS is generating surplus energy that has, on average, been sold at a loss on the secondary market for 7 to 9 years. The amount of surplus has never dropped below the amount of LSRD generation except for less than about 20 hours scattered over the last 15 years. As such, breaching will have little impact on meeting loads for BPA's preferred customers, i.e. public power, and this voids claims that the LSRD baseload power is worth millions, or now billions, as it's found in Congressman Simpson's concepts. So to avoid further losses, BPA and the Corps should undertake immediate breaching. Third resolution, the LSRDs are 40 to 50% more expensive to operate than the other large FCRPS dams. All dams are always increasing in cost due to the aging technologies and lack of industrial base to support it. As such, the FCRPS needs to be optimized with explosive growth of wind, solar, and battery systems by breaching the LSRDs and shifting money to the storage, other dams, and their grid. This will ensure a reliable system at lower rates. And fourth, the district should insist on defunding the LSRDs. If BPA stops funding the LSRDs, the Corps will have no choice but to put them into a non-operational status, and they would do this via removing the earthen berms, as this is the only practical way to secure them and to restore a free-flowing river. So those are just some summary comments. I have provided you guys several dozens of pages of supporting documentation around these comments. And so I guess that's what I'm trying to say here is that I think the statements in the resolution are not exactly in line with a lot of data and reported documentation. Yes, they sort of reflect what we often hear in summary documents and position statements, even in the record of decision, but that doesn't make it right. So that's my comments, Will.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Other comments, questions from the commission? Okay, well, do we have a motion?
Well, this is Rick. I move that we accept, I move that we accept resolution 2194-21.
Okay, and I will, Jim, I assume you're not going to second that, so I'll second it. So it's been moved and seconded for approval to adopt resolution 2194-21, supporting the federal Columbia River Power System, recognizing its role in environmental stewardship, and opposing the removal of the Lower Snake River dams. All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Nay, I'm opposed.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, our next item is resolution 2145-21, authorizing the disposal of surplus property. Terry, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. Good afternoon.
Okay.
I'm Terry Lind, operations superintendent in the Port Angeles service area, including the district's auto shop. Staff requests that the commission pass resolution number 2195-21, authorizing disposal of one McMaster 250 multi-use welder, which is no longer usable or repairable and has no value. Please let me know if I can answer any questions. Thank you.
Question on this, or is there comments or questions? Seems to be straightforward.
Yeah, it's a welder that it had run. We used it for years, and then it would run for a while, and it'd stop, and you'd have to let it cool down. So it ended up being a circuit board problem, and the circuit boards are no longer serviceable or replaceable for that. So we replaced it with another welder. We did save all the leads and clamps and stuff from it that we can use with our other welders.
So is this a generator welder, or what we used to call a cracker box?
Well, it's a multi-use. You can use it for a number of different welding applications. You can use it as a wire feed, or you can also use it as a stick welder up to 250 amps.
Okay. All right. So do we have a motion or other comments?
I move that we accept resolution 2195-21, authorizing disposal of surplus property.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded for approval of resolution 2195-21, authorizing the disposal of surplus property, which consists of one Big Master 250, I'm not sure what that is, S/N, which is no longer usable or repairable and has no value. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, the next item is CETA Energy Assistance for Low-Income Households. Final analysis, CETA Section 12. This is going to be Sean and John Purvis.
Actually, Will, I think invitation to bid is prior to us.
Oh, I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes, John Purvis is going to present that in lieu of Bill Decker.
Okay, all right. So this is invitation to bid number 211003 for pole inspection, treating, and reporting. John, I'm sorry that I almost missed you.
No problem at all. Good afternoon, commissioners. This is our annual contract pole test and treat program. We've been doing this since the 1980s. And staff recommendation is to request a motion, second, and vote to authorize staff to solicit quotations for bid number 211003 for a contractor to inspect, treat, and report on an unspecified number of electrical transmission and distribution wood poles. The number of poles is undetermined at this time. The location of the work is in Clallam County. The project will have an estimated not to exceed amount of $129,368, excluding Washington State sales tax. Now, normally during these presentations, we try to get about 2,000 poles, which represents approximately 10% of our system. And we do this on a 10-year rotation. Now, the inspectors will be moving into the SQUIM area, and we actually expect better condition of poles and perhaps maybe even a larger number than 2,000. We just don't have the number at this time. This contract is a unit cost contract based on about 11 items that we estimate the number of poles for, but in the end, we do a bid evaluation on the unit cost and the proposals. Last year, there were four bidders, and we expect four or five bidders this time.
So this is unit pricing, and we're estimating the number of poles, and that's how we get the not-to-exceed amount. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
John, in the BOC package were several pre-qualification statements, and that's what the sun is killing me here. And so that's what those pre-qualification statements are for pole inspections. They're having to deal with this particular.
Actually, Jim, most of the pre-qual, in fact, all of the pre-qual that I'm familiar with, I think we had four of them in the consent agenda. They are contractors lining up for a large transmission project the board authorized between airport and BPA Port Angeles.
Thanks for the clarification.
So I'll inject a question here. There was quite an in-depth, deep dive into, I think it was PARS as a qualified bidder qualification. Is there some reason all the it's more submittal than we normally see? So
yes, and basically PARS is a very large company, and this is not on the Poultice and Treat, but they're a very large company with 26 offices. And when we did our review, we did note a number of citations and reporting that we now require, national level reporting on L&I type of issues. And they did have more than the number that we expect. But when you narrow it down to and consider the 25 offices, 2,200 employees, and basically enough to outfit almost 800 crews across the country, and you just look at Washington and the Pacific Northwest, there are no outstanding L&I citations at this time. Staff recommended approval. I believe that was submitted in the package to bring that to your attention because it's something we typically do not see in the past for the smaller companies, such as the other three that have made applications. But that is a very good point, Will, and you did see a lot more than you normally would. We put that in front of you because of there were, a number of L&I citations, but they were in other states.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry I kind of got off script here. Let's go back to the poll inspection, treating, and reporting invitation to bid. Do I have a motion on that one?
Will, I move that we accept the invitation to solicit quotes for polls, inspection, testing, and reporting.
I'll second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to accept the authorized staff to solicit quotations for bid number 211003. For a contractor to inspect, treat, and report on unspecified number of electrical transmission and distribution wood poles, the number of poles is undetermined at this time. Location of the work is Clallam County. The project will have an estimated not to exceed amount of $129,368, not including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, moving on to item D, which is the CETA energy assistance for low-income households, the final analysis of CETA Section 12. Why don't we take a short break here before we get into that? About 5 minutes, does that sound okay?
That sounds great.
Okay, about 5 minutes. We'll be back here at 2:42. Okay, it's 2:42. Is everyone back? Sean, are you there? Yeah, I see you. Okay. Well, let's move on to the CETA Energy Assistance for Low-Income Households presentation, and that's Sean and John, I believe.
Yep. Let me share my screen here, Will. Can you see that?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, Clean Energy Transformation Act, coming up this year, we have several milestones that we're going to have to meet. One of them being, as Doug alluded to earlier, the Clean Energy Implementation Plan. That's going to be due at the end of this year, and every 4 years thereafter, we're going to have to complete that. But first, July 31st of this year, we have to have a CETA low-income program in place that meets the new legislation. And so with that, staff has gone through and done some analysis in-house, and because of the large financial impact, we consulted with FCS Group to sort of corroborate our internal analysis and make sure that we were coming up with similar cost structures. So today, for the POD, John and myself are going to be talking about this legislation as it relates to low income. I'm going to give a brief overview, and then John's going to go over the internal analysis by the utility. And then FCS Group is going to follow John and talk about their analysis, and then at the very end, I'm going to sort of follow up with a recommended program.
Yeah, Sean, you might tell us what FCS is.
FCS Group is who we've used in the past to do our cost of service. They're a consulting firm out of the Seattle area that works with quite a few PUDs in Washington State on coastal-related activities and analysis. So they're well-versed in this type of data and provided similar analysis to what we did internally. So first thing, what is RCW 19.405.120? So when the drafters of CETA originally brought forth a mandate to bring Washington to a clean energy state, through multiple iterations, there was a Section 12 that got input into the into legislation. And the Section 12 didn't have anything to do with clean energy per se, but rather a mandate onto utilities that they had to provide low-income programs as the state transitioned to clean energy. And so, taken from the legislation, it says that the intent of the legislature is to make progress toward making energy assistance funds available to low-income households. And this legislation is different from the Energy Independence Act in that there's no provision that would give small utilities an exemption. So even utilities under 25,000 customers are still required to make programs and funding available for energy assistance to low-income households by July 31st of this year. The legislation also says that priority must be given to low-income households with a higher energy burden, and I'll explain energy burden on the next slide here. And then programs can include direct monetary assistance or conservation measures to reduce energy burden. So what that means is that the utility can give customers on direct monetary assistance like a bill credit, similar to the program that we have in place now. And on the conservation measures, let's say you have a customer that has baseboard heating. The utility could have a program in place where the utility goes in, puts in a ductless heat pump, and in theory, that should lower the customer's overall energy consumption and thereby reduce energy burden. So energy burden and energy assistance. Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
That last point you were making about conservation, could that also include putting solar, you know, giving them, providing solar panels?
I'm not sure, but I would think so. As long as you could show that you were reducing the customer's energy burden through conservation measures, I believe that would qualify.
Yes, this is John. That is correct. Any conservation measure that reduces energy burden or reduces utility costs in the form of community solar, weatherization, those type of projects would be compliant.
Well, you're going to get to this, but isn't there a cap on this?
Actually, on the low-income side, there's not.
Wow. Okay.
All right. I may come back to that later, but go ahead, Sean.
Okay. So the legislation uses these two terms quite a bit. The first is energy burden, and the second is energy assistance need. And so energy burden is the percentage of household income that goes towards household energy costs. And household energy costs are things outside of electricity, too, such as wood, propane, or basically any fuel source that would be used in heating the home. And then energy assistance need is the amount of assistance needed over and above 6% energy burden. I know that's confusing, but here's an example. If the household income is $36,000 and the total household energy costs are $2,880 per year, then that customer's energy burden would be 8%. So you take the energy cost, divide it into the income, and you get the 8%.
So that's something of a cap on expenditures there.
It's not a cap on expenditures. That's determining what a customer's energy assistance need would be.
But what they qualify for.
What they qualify for, right.
$720 per year. Okay.
Yeah, so basically in this example, being 8%, you would take 8, subtract it from the 6% cap, and that would be $720 per year that this customer would be eligible for assistance. So when they drafted the legislation, I think part of them knew that utilities were not necessarily set up to administer this type of program. So they put some restrictions as to what Department of Commerce needs to supply to the utilities. And basically, Commerce is tasked with collecting and aggregating data that will estimate energy burden and energy assistance need for each utility, and they'll provide that to us every 2 years. They'll also publish data with estimated number and demographic characteristics for each utility. They're working on this now. They've started working on an online portal that utilities can go in and start getting this data. Unfortunately, it's not ready yet. And what we're being told is that it's likely Commerce will not meet the July 31st deadline. So utilities are basically tasked with implementing their own programs prior to this data coming out. They're also tasked with providing estimated level of energy burden and energy assistance need for each utility, as well as housing characteristics, including housing type and energy efficiency potential. I'm guessing it'll be something similar to what we do every 2 years with our conservation potential assessment, hopefully some type of data similar to that. On the utility side, we have some responsibilities. Every 2 years, we have to submit an assessment of these following bullet points. The first is programs and mechanisms used to reduce energy burden and the effectiveness of those programs. So basically, we have to report every 2 years, did the program that we put in place, was it successful in reducing customers' energy burden? What outreach strategies we use to encourage participation of eligible households? And then sort of the big one here, a cumulative assessment of previous funding levels for energy assistance compared to the funding levels needed to meet these following three things. 60% of the current energy assistance need, increasing energy assistance by 15% over the amount provided in 2018. And then what is it going to take to eliminate 90% of the current energy assistance need by 2050? So these three bullet points here is sort of the crux of the meat of this presentation that John and FCS Group are going to get into, the numbers. And as you'll see, there's some glaring financial impacts associated with what it's going to take to achieve this. And finally, the utility is responsible to provide a plan to improve the effectiveness of the assessed mechanisms and strategies toward meeting the energy assistance need goals. So with that, I'll turn it over to John, and then following him will be Sergey and Matt with FCS Group.
Hey, Sean, are you going to flip through the slides, or do you want me to share a screen?
No problem. I can flip through them if you want.
Okay. So basically, Back in October, we gave an extensive CETA presentation. There was almost 100 slides, and a substantial portion of that presentation did look at CETA Section 12. Also provided in your packet is a copy of the district's analysis of RCW 19405.120, which is CETA Section 12. And we did that back in April of last year, and it was based on 2019 meter data. The presentation, this presentation incorporates subsequent information that we've learned over the last year, as well as a corroborative analysis conducted by the FCS group. The two analyses have very similar outcomes, utilizing independent and differing methodologies. And at this point in the rulemaking, I think the rulemaking came out was finalized in December, January. There still remains critical questions, which Sean touched on. We're obligated to demonstrate progress towards meeting energy assistance needs goals through biannual reporting. There's no objective definition of progress towards. Is progress towards a dollar, or is it towards actually meeting the objectives and the timeframes suggested? And as Sean mentioned, the state is not expected to provide the utilities the data needed to make program assessments before July 31st, 2021, so we have to start ours without that information. Next slide. Okay, next slide. That's backwards. There you go. According to staff analysis, approximately 8,700 of our 2,800 residential customers have household income below the 200% federal poverty level. About 6,200 of these customers have energy assistance need, and about 35% of the total electric billings for customers below 200% of the federal poverty level is energy assistance need. So 35% of utility bills for the 6,200 customers is EAN that we try to reduce and eliminate. The total EAN for our entire service territory is $4.1 million, which is close to 6.7% of the PUD overall revenue. And there is a 2030 target to eliminate $2,477,000 by 2030, and by 2050, we should reach 90%, which is more than 3.7 million. And to give an idea of what we have been doing, in 2020 we had our highest energy assistance numbers in history, partly due to COVID and other reasons, at well under $400,000, applied to 1,100 customers, a small fraction of the need. And we expect or believe about 1,800 customers currently receive help from other sources. So when you total those together, around 800,000 compared to almost 2.5 million by 2030, we have a high hurdle coming up if we have to do this through our ratepayers. Next screen. Okay, graphically, this shows the breakdown of customers in groups. About 30% of our customers have incomes or household incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level, and the overwhelming majority of those customers do have energy assistance need. When you get into the next group, 200 to 400%, you even have some energy assistance need, and by definition, but those are not eligible for any remediation. So this gives you the customer count where they stand on income. Next slide. Okay, now this is the dollar value of the energy assistance need for 200% below poverty level, as well as the value of other residential customers in the next two bars, and the last one, all other customers, commercial accounts, industrial accounts. And if you look at the gold section in the first bar, in 2030, we'd be looking to mitigate 60% of that. And if our jurisdiction is the only jurisdiction that does that, we don't have expanded federal and state programs, it does mean a substantial rate increase for customers who are not low income if we have to fund this through utility programs entirely. Hopefully, we're hoping that the state and federal governments come through on some of this assistance. Next screen. Okay, so we did this analysis, spent more than a couple weeks on it last year so that we could make decisions necessary to implement CETA Section 12, to develop and implement the compliant low-income programs. And right now, we'll be honest with you, we don't know how the state is looking at this. This may be an exercise in collection of data, or eventually through our BNM reporting, we may actually have to, using our own resources, meet the legislative targets. It's unclear, and we don't have any answer from the state because the state at this point does not know. And Sean touched on this, but the 2% annual cap associated with the general CETA legislation does not apply to Section 12, and that's our former staff attorney interpretation, as well as other staff interpretation. In the rulemaking comments, working with APUDA and direct department discussions with Commerce, staff has emphasized that CETA Section 12 attempts to address an income inequality issue. And as a matter of fundamental fairness, the primary funding sources to meet Section 12 objectives should not be pushed to small jurisdictions such as PUDs, and primarily because poverty rates and affluence of local jurisdictions vary widely, and a large EAN need should not be remedied by a disproportionately small non-low-income ratepayer base. You can't compare Clallam PUD to Seattle. In Seattle, there's a much smaller sliver of energy assistance need compared to a much larger group of customers that can mitigate that energy assistance need. Our county is relatively high in poverty and low in affluence. Next screen.
So okay. With that...
let me make a couple comments about this. Because as Sean's about to say, we contract with the FCS group to present an individual analysis on EAN and CETA Section 12. And one of the reasons for this, FCS has a wide variety of information resources that is not available to staff, including information that allows analysis based on the other alternative, which is 80% of the area median income, as well as comparable data to other utilities. And I've taken a close look at FCS on this particular analysis, and I can attest that it's sound and very strong. They did an exceptional job on the analysis they're about to present.
So you're kind of in a dilemma here. If you fund this by raising rates, it just means more people will qualify for EAN.
Well, we're going to try. Sean's going to get into that later.
Yeah, I know you are, but I wanted to make that comment because it's kind of a circular thing. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so thanks, John. So with that, I'll turn it over to Sergey and Matt with FCS. I believe they're both on the presentation here, and they can go through their slides. And, Sergey, I'll be happy to advance the slides as you need me to.
Thank you, Sean, and thanks for the introduction. My name is Sergey Tarasov. I'm a project manager with FCS Group. As Sean described, I was a part of the prior rate study update, so we are familiar with the PUD. So what we're going to do is just we're going to outline our methodology, kind of go over our process and our findings as well. Matt Hobson, who's also a project manager with us, with FCS Group, will lead that discussion. And then towards the end, we'll touch upon a quick discussion of what we found, kind of trying to survey and identify what other folks are doing with CETA in terms of complying with this Section 12. What are they doing? What are they finding? And kind of what is kind of the general feeling throughout Washington towards the CETA. So, Matt, are you online?
I am. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Something is not
cooking with my video today, so I apologize. I promise I am 6'4" and a strong 250 pounds, I promise. So as Sergey mentioned, we were contracted by Collin County QD to do an independent evaluation of the CETA impacts for two purposes. One, to develop kind of a rate impact, and then also for comparative purposes to compare with the internal analysis created by the districts. So simply put, we were asked to develop our own methodology to assess the energy burden and the energy assistance needs within the PUD service area, and then to compare those results with those developed by the PUD staff. Generally, the results that we developed from this independent analysis are consistent with the staff's internal estimates. At a high level, we estimate approximately $4 million in energy assistance needs today. As part of our scope as well, we also surveyed other public utility districts to identify what actions, if any, they have already taken, whether they plan to take regarding the CETA affordability requirements. Next slide, Sean. So our methodology follows five key steps. First, we estimated the number of households that could potentially qualify for energy assistance based on household income. And we assessed household income on two metrics. One was households at or below 80% of the area median household income. That's about $38,000 per year. And then another income metric, households at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. That is equivalent to about $49,000 per year for a family of four. The second step was to develop an estimate of annual electric costs for households based on household income and size. And for this step, we evaluated regional data from the U.S. Census Bureau, as well as actual customer billing data from 2019. Those first two steps provide kind of the foundation for step three, which is determining the number of households within the service area that could potentially qualify for energy assistance based on their income and their annual electric costs. As Sean mentioned earlier, this is kind of a critical distinction here. To qualify for energy assistance, CETA requires that both of these conditions be met, that there's a relatively low household income and there's a certain level of electric costs. For the fourth step, we take the estimate of qualifying households and we develop an estimate of the level of energy assistance need. And this is a step where we determine that $4 million annual energy assistance need for the PUD. And then finally, the last step was to estimate the cost of the energy assistance need to other customers who would likely be expected to pay for that assistance need. Next slide. So step one, estimate the number of households that could potentially qualify for energy assistance based on their income alone. And the following graph illustrates the distribution of households in Collin County by household income. Generally speaking, households that fall within those first 10 bars on the left could potentially qualify for energy assistance based on their income alone. Next slide. However, depending on how we measure household income, there's going to be a range of potential households that would qualify. If we use the area median income as the metric for income, it results in more qualifying households compared to the federal poverty level metric. Roughly 38% of households would qualify using the area median income metric compared to just 30%, or compared to 30% if we use the federal poverty level metric. The difference between those two is because of the income threshold for area median income is slightly lower than for the federal poverty level metric. So, to provide a conservative estimate of the level of energy assistance need, we use the larger number, the area median income metric. What that tells us is for the roughly 29,000 residential accounts in the service area, we would expect between 11,600 to 12,000 customers that would have an annual income below 80% of the area median income, and those folks those households would potentially qualify for energy assistance need under the CEDAR requirements. Next slide. So step two determines an estimate for annual electric costs for households based on household income and size. And the columns in this graph illustrate reported annual electric costs based on household income. So the dark gray portion of each bar, that's the reported annual electric costs, while the light gray bar is for all other energy costs for that household, be it gas or fuel. When we look at the bars from left to right, oh, can you go back there? When we look at the bars from left to right, we can see that the annual energy costs, they increase as income increases. That first bar, which is for households with income 0 to 30% of area median income, so that's about $14,000 per year in income, you can see the reported electric costs. The second bar is for the 30 to 60% of area median income. And then the third bar would be those households with up to 80% of area median income. Once again, it's around $37,000 per year. Generally, annual electric costs increase with household income to a certain degree. You can see that there is still a base level of electric costs for households with very little income. A household with $14,000 in income would still anticipate seeing, on average, about $1,000, almost $1,100 in annual electric bill costs. Next slide. We saw similar trends in reviewing the residential customer billing data from 2019, where this chart illustrates the distribution of annual electric costs for residential customers in 2019 as billed by the PUDs. These are not self-reported. These are actual annual electric costs in 2019, and most customers had annual electric bill somewhere in the $1,000 to $1,800 range. Next slide. So when we combine household income and household electric costs, we get an idea of electric burden. And as Sean mentioned, electric burden is the share of a household income that goes to electric costs. And it's the metric used by CEDA to define energy assistance. So to qualify for energy assistance, CEDA rules establish that thresholds for household income and annual electric costs be met. And so based on these guidelines, a household would have to spend more than about little over 5% of their income on electric costs and also qualify via low income status to receive assistance. And that creates kind of three unique buckets on our service area. We could potentially have some accounts that have very low incomes, but also for whatever reason, low energy costs, and they could potentially not qualify for assistance. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we could have folks with high energy bills, but high incomes as well, and they would also not qualify. So we're looking more for the account B example where there are households with low income, and also have relatively high energy costs. Next slide.
I have a question here then. This is Jim Waddell speaking. It looks like then if you really are low income and you can't really pay your electric bill to heat your house at a comfortable level, and therefore you're running around in your wool jackets and stuff, and you've cut your heat bill down, you might be the person that needs this assistance the most, but you might just be disqualified because your ratio wasn't appropriate or correct or qualified.
Okay. Great question. And the purpose of the analysis and kind of the framework was not to necessarily establish individual households' eligibility, but these metrics are used to identify the total cost burden to the PUD. So the PUD could elect to use the total funding amount to address certain households, even if they have low energy costs because they're just keeping their thermostat very low.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to build on Jim's comment, we haven't looked at this for a while, but there used to be quite a lot of people using wood for heat. So, again, they wouldn't qualify either, huh?
Yeah. So these metrics are used to establish the total funding pool. Of course, the PUD would have ability to distribute that funding to meet its low-income affordability goals. So the chart here that illustrates the electric burden concept for a sample of 100 households. So each of those dots, those blue dots, is one household. Each blue dot is the share of a household income that's currently going towards electric costs today. And then each orange dot is the share of the household income that should be going towards electric costs under the CETA guidelines. So where we have orange and blue dots at the same point, if you look in the middle of the graph, maybe towards the right of the chart, they're in the same position. And these are examples of where the household's energy bills are consistent with the affordability requirements dictated by CETA. It's where the blue dots on the left side of the chart, where they're well above the orange dots, those would be that the households, they're currently spending more than that threshold on their income and therefore would require energy assistance from the PUD based on CETA requirements. The area in green represents the total energy assistance required for the PUD to meet that affordability standard. Next slide. So based on our analysis, we estimate that there are roughly 8,300 to 8,500 residential accounts of the total 29,000 accounts that have an energy burden requiring assistance from the PUD. That's equivalent to just under 30% of all accounts. The remaining 20,000 accounts would not be part of the equation for the energy burden funding requirement. Next slide. So step four of the methodology establishes a dollar estimate for the energy assistance need of qualifying households. The first column of this table shows total residential revenue collected by the PUD. So we have about $44.5 million in total annual revenue today, of which about $11 million is being generated from households who currently have an energy assistance need under CETA requirements. The remaining $30 million in annual revenue is being generated from other households that don't qualify for the energy assistance. The second column of the table estimates the revenue that should be generated by each of these groups under CETA guidelines. So that first line, for those customers that currently would qualify, they are currently paying about $11 million. Based on CETA requirements, the total revenue from that group should be about $7 million. And so the difference, or $4 million, is where our estimate is for the level of energy assistance that exists today. Next slide. So CETA establishes funding targets to be met for energy assistance in 2030 and in 2050. By 2030, that funding level must be at 60% of your current energy assistance need. And to John's point, the CETA rules are a bit ambiguous as to whether the funding target is based on a straight percentage level of funding or whether it's a percentage of qualifying households. And so due to this ambiguity, we estimate the 2030 funding target to be somewhere in the range of $2.4 million to $3.2 million. And then by 2050, the funding target should be 90% of current need, which we estimate at $3.6 to $3.9 million. Next slide. So to meet that 2030 funding target, the PUD would need to increase rates by 0.5% to 0.7% each year between now and 2030, and these rate increases would be above any other needed increases to support additional operating and power expenses. And if we look more at the long-term 2050 funding target, because it's further out in the future, you'd have a lot more time to phase in those rate adjustments. And so looking at 2050 funding horizon, rate increases would be more in the line of 0.2 to 0.3% each year from now through the time period. So because the CETA funding targets are long-term targets, the actual rate impacts may end up varying from these estimates. And so as a secondary analysis, we contacted several other public utilities in the region just to understand what actions they're pursuing relative to CETA. And I'm going to pass the baton to Sergey to kind of talk to those findings.
Thanks, Matt. So as Matt mentioned, we reached out to quite a few utilities. We received several answers to our survey questions. And basically what we found is a majority of folks, majority of other PUDs, as well as some cities and other utilities are kind of taking the wait and see and are really overwhelmed by ACETA. They're not even sure how to address it. I try to reach out and follow up with some of those utilities after ACETA was passed when it was finalized, because the majority of our discussions occurred last summer, kind of preliminary surveying when it was still in the draft form, just to see if anybody is being as proactive as Clallam has been by trying to address it ahead of time. And we found that two on our list were trying to somewhat address it. The first one was Tremont PD. They were quite a bit proactive. They went and they had their own approach that they developed, which sounded fairly complicated in the manner how they acquired the data. And then we also talked to Snohomish PD. They believe, because of their broad reaching and just enhanced low-income program, because they automatically enroll folks in low-income if they're enrolled in any kind of program in the county, they believe they would just be already complying with their requirements in a slightly different approach, because they're so their low-income program is already broad-reaching. They feel like they're going to qualify. Walsh & Lahn's doing a similar exercise to Clallam, where they're trying to actually estimate the need. Now, again, when I followed up with the utilities after the fact, similar sentiment was present. Some of them were still waiting for the data from Commerce, which, as we heard from John and Sean, that most likely will not be, the Commerce will not meet the deadline as well. So, you know, in terms of the analysis side, Clallam PD has been ahead of the curve trying to just estimate it and identify it. But as we were performing the analysis, we also, as John pointed out, you know, are seeing several issues from the regulation because it's such a broad-reaching requirement without taking into account the demographics and the cost of power that are placed upon each individual county. If you're looking at this graphic on this slide, you'll see kind of distribution of average energy burden by federal poverty level. And as you can see in this sample, we have six utilities. The first three are Clallam, Okanagan, and Port Angeles. The next three are Snohomish, Seattle, and Chelan. As you can see on the lower end of the poverty level, the need or the burden is quite a bit higher for Clallam, Okanagan, and Port Angeles. Now, if you're looking at somebody like Chelan PD, their cost of power is so low that their burden just automatically is much lower. So the resource portfolio, the cost of power, has a substantial impact on each utility's burden. Another item we're finding is that because you have to spread, or you're allowed to spread the burden of covering the difference through your non-low-income customers, qualifying customers, the base of your load that you're providing service to, being as in commercial and industrial type loads, can make a substantial difference. So utilities that have large commercial industrial presence, those utilities can spread the burden over a bigger customer base versus smaller utilities that only provide primarily service to residential. So the requirements are kind of non-discriminatory, but in the sense they're putting a lot more pressure on smaller utilities, lower demographic utilities from an income perspective, as well as just utilities that just mainly focus on residential service and don't have a large commercial presence.
So the other point there is that Chelan's rates are low because they are a generator. They have dams. So that kind of explains what they're doing.
Right. So I think with that, Sean, you're going to – the next slides are yours.
Yeah, I'll take it from there, Sergey. Thanks, Matt and Sergey. I appreciate it. So I guess that leads us to what do we do at Clallam? We have an existing program right now where we offer discounts on our basic customer charge each month, and it's either 100% off, 75% off, or 50% off. Those programs have worked well for years, but unfortunately they are not eligible to meet the requirements of CETA because they're limited in scope, and we only allow them to senior and disabled customers. And this legislation states that it has to be eligible to all low-income customers. So what our plan is on August 1st of this year, we would begin phasing out the existing program that we have. Now, there's going to be some overlap between notifying our existing customers, the existing customers applying for the new program, and then from when we phase it out. So what we're thinking is that we'll notify our existing customers via a mailing campaign next month and basically just let them know that we're going to discontinue our existing program, and at some point in the very near future, you're going to receive a second mailing that's going to direct you to apply for the new program. The reason we're not going to blast everybody at once is just quite frankly, with 1,100 existing customers on the program, we can't handle that many applications all at once coming in, so we're going to try and stagger the reapplications. And we'll give ample time for the customers to reapply. The intent is to not have anybody miss out on assistance that they should have otherwise received.
So along with that, Sean, there needs to be a lot of information before you cancel these programs. You know, we kind of act as a buffer between the legislation and the public. We need to make sure that they know why we're doing this, and it has been mandated by Olympia.
Yeah, we were even thinking, Will, too, of including within the letters a copy of the legislation. One thing that go ahead, Rick.
This is Rick. I'm just throwing this out for food for thought. I'd like to minimize the burden that we put on these low-income households. And you may not know the answer to this off the top of your head, but of the ones that are qualifying now for some discounts, do we know whether any of them would not qualify under the new program?
There's a very good chance that we will have some customers that do not qualify for the new program. And quite honestly, the reason being is that we just are not equipped to adequately underwrite customers' finances. If somebody brings in a copy of a Social Security award letter, for example, we have no way to ascertain whether or not that's the only household income. And my next slide here kind of gets into what we're proposing. The legislation authorizes consumer-owned utilities such as PUDs to partner with a cap agency. Now, these organizations are equipped to handle this type of program. They have the resources and technology to, you know, honestly assess a customer's income and also ascertain what the energy burden and energy assistance need is for that customer. So working with OLECAP, they would determine the customer's assistance level, and they would also communicate to us the type of assistance that they're going to pledge, whether it be direct monetary assistance to the customer's account or some type of conservation measure. Our proposal is that we provide OLECAP with 15% above our 2018 assistance level, and that would be for the time period of August 1st of this year through 12/31 of next year in the amount of $460,000. And then we would also provide them with an additional $40,000 to assist with agency overheads. We've had multiple conversations with OLECAP, and to roll out this program, they are going to have to staff appropriately. And the beauty of partnering with OLECAP is that when a customer goes to them, they have a myriad of different opportunities for the customer to receive assistance. They have LIHEAP, they have renter's assistance, they have homeowner's assistance. They have all kinds of tools at their disposal to help customers. So rather than making them go to OLECAP and then come to us, it'll be more of a one-stop shop for these customers that need the assistance the most. OLECAP would also help us track the disbursements and the awards and meet the state reporting requirements. We have to report to the state the energy assistance need, the percent of the poverty level, and there's a multitude of things we're going to have to report, and Commerce is supposed to provide us with a online template where we'll do this reporting. We haven't seen that yet, so I'm not exactly sure what they're going to be looking for, but I'm going to assume that it's going to be pretty granular on a household data level. So just kind of a high level, the program that we administer through the PUD would go away, and OLECAP would be the new program administrator for the district's low-income program. Did that help, Rick?
It did. I guess my concern is, or what I'd like to see is for us to prime the pump, if you will, for those that are already in an existing program, instead of, you know, just cutting them off and saying, okay, now you've got to reapply for this other new program. If there's any way that we could assist and help, like I said, prime the pump for them, make it as easy for those folks as possible.
Yeah, one of the ideas that we've come working with OLECAP is that we would have an OLECAP employee come to the PUD here. We would open up the boardroom and provide copier services as well as an on-site CSR to help with the assistance of customers to apply. Because one thing OLECAP needs from us when a customer applies for LIHEAP or any electric assistance is 12 months worth of usage history. And so when we send out these letters, we're going to include an application in the letter. We'll give the customers a copy of all their usage data and basically pre-fill out as much of the information as we possibly can. OLECAP, you know, in the age of COVID, they are struggling. They said that, you know, to get customers, that they're not doing in-person appointments right now. And so going through phone and email and snail mail has been challenging for them, but they are getting a whole slew of additional CARES funding that's going to be coming through, as well as our program. So they are staffing up right now, and they said that if we could open up our boardroom to their personnel and assist them, that they would be much appreciated. And I didn't really see a problem with that.
Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
So,
hey, Sean, this is Jim.
Go ahead.
I have a question. Does OLECAP have the capability to really deal with conservation, technical issues and guidance and so forth? And what would be their incentive to do that with a low-income customer versus just the monetary assistance, you know, giving them money?
Right. In the beginning, Jim, I'm quite confident that it's going to be primarily direct monetary assistance. And the reason I say that is because if we were to install a you know, ductless heat pump in a customer's house that cost $2,500, when maybe that $2,500 could have been spent on helping 10 other customers instead of just one, with a finite pool of money, they're going to reach the most people with the direct assistance. Now, they did say that they are planning on, post-COVID, They have had conservation programs in the past. They used to have vans that would run around town and do duct sealing and insulation inspections. And so they are planning on reinventing that conservation program. And I believe that down the road, several years, that with additional assistance from us, that that's where they're looking. But in the beginning, it would primarily be direct assistance.
Hey, Sean, I'll add that the CAP agency is actually liaisoning with other CAP agencies in other states, doing a review of their weatherization programs in the context of our program. So initially, we expect it to start out this first period is direct assistance, but our expectation is that there'll be a ratio or a proportion of high-value weatherization projects that will be effective of reducing the energy burden, especially for those that have high kilowatt-hour usage, which our program does not apply to, or the future direct assistance will not apply to.
Well, I guess my angling here is that conservation can help us reduce peak demand and load issues. So there's a payback for us, which means all customers. So I know there's a ratio, a calculation that has to be done there, but I would just encourage as we move forward on this thing with OLECAP is that we, look at these conservation equations and figure out whether that makes, when does that make sense versus a monetary payment.
Another aspect of that is that I would assume a lot of these folks are renters if they're in the low income and having trouble being able or they're paying a larger percentage of their income for electric bills. And I can't help but believe or fear that the landlords may end up with a real benefit if we go in and pay for, you know, more insulation or improving the rental house, which I understand would lower the electric bill for that person that's renting it, but it's also going to be benefiting the person who owns the house.
Yeah, and honestly, Rick, Commerce has brought that up, and they're very aware of that dilemma.
Yeah, but we're hoping that if they do apply it to renter's assistance, that perhaps the housing be classified as designated for low income as a solution, so that any follow-on customers will derive the same benefit as the incumbent.
So, do we know what the ongoing cost, administration cost, MotorCAP's going to be for this program?
We don't. We've had multiple conversations, but it's probably going to be one full-time employee with overheads.
Yeah, I know in the past it was a couple of agencies that came to the PUD, St. Vincent de Paul, and I don't remember the other one, but and they were pointing out that they could do this stuff a lot cheaper, although they don't have the capability to administer something like this, I wouldn't think. So.
Yeah, it's you know, honestly, Will, our staff versus their staff doing it, they can do it cheaper than what we can, and they're also tied into the state databases and have access to information that we just don't have access to. So they're set up to administer this type of program where we're just simply at a handicap. We just don't have the ability to do it like they do.
So based on that, Sean, if we had to do it in-house, it would be more expensive and more than one person, huh?
I mean, we could probably do it ourselves with one person, but it would be more expensive.
Yeah, okay.
So the financial impact, which is something that John and Sergey talked about, but in the immediate impact is, you know, what do we do? And the creative way to mitigate any rate impact would be to have a line item assessment on the bill, and we could call it CETA low income compliance or some variation thereof. And vulnerable communities and low income, in the legislation, it states that they're not to pay for the clean energy benefits derived from CETA. And so what would happen is you would take all the customers in the county as a whole and subtract out the low income and the vulnerable populations, and the rest of the ratepayers would see a line item assessment on the bill of approximately $1.40 per month. And so what would happen is initially all customers would be assessed this charge with a few caveats, the first being that if you apply through OLECAP and are determined to be low income and meet the requirements of CETA, they would notify us, and then that charge would be waived from your bill. And then all tribal customers on tribal lands that are exempt from paying public utility tax and privilege tax are considered vulnerable populations and therefore would automatically be exempt from the monthly assessment. And it doesn't make sense to incorporate into rates because then you are charging the vulnerable and the low income, and then also keeping it out of rates eliminates any compounding and perpetuity of these costs in the rates. And in order to meet the 2050 goal of the 90% energy assistance need being accomplished, you know, we're obviously going to have to monitor this very closely and adjust the line item charge on a yearly basis and sort of do a true up every year to see how close we are to how many customers we have that qualify. In the beginning, it's going to be a very educated guess until we actually know how many customers will qualify and actually apply. But our best guess right now is that it'll be about $1.40 per month. And then that assessment would go into effect with the new program on August 1st. So with that, basically we'll open it up to any questions or discussion. I believe Sergey and his group is still on. If you have any more questions for them or any for me and John, we're happy to answer them.
We have no idea what the 90% compliance would cost, that assessment would be. Is that? It's going to be about 40 initially, but it's going to go up over time.
To meet the 90% by 2050 is about $3.8 million in today's dollars.
Yeah. Which equates to what kind of assessment?
Oh, you mean on the it'd be very large. I could figure that out for you, Will, and get it out to you.
That's what I'm getting. It sounds like it could be very large.
Well, we calculate it's up to 6.7% increase for the 60% target. And so you could be pushing 9 or 10% rate increase for the cumulative rate increase for the 90% target. Yeah. But that's a caveat. The state or the federal government will be providing some of that money. So we cannot say definitively what it would be. The high end, 90%, 9 or 10% rate increase for incomes above 200% federal poverty level.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
I didn't like the content, but that was a good presentation.
Yes, it was.
Thanks,
Rick. You make bad news sound good.
I do my best.
Sergey, you look like you're at the Louvre there or something with that background.
I like the space. It helps me think.
There we go.
Yeah, and just a side note, you guys will be seeing Sergey later this year. They're doing an update on our cost of service for electric, so they'll be coming back to us probably later at the end of summer.
Okay, good.
And thanks, Sergey and Matt. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time. Great to see everybody. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Sergey. So anything else on that, Sean or John?
No, sir, that was it.
Okay, moving on, correspondence communication. Doug, do we have any?
Nothing today, Will.
All right, commissioner reports. Rick, you want to kick that off?
Sure. I was attended a number of WAPUTA meetings this week. I thought that they were well put together and enjoyed them. Other than that, nothing significant to report.
Yeah, we'll get the tests over there, and then I got the forms and everything that you gave me posted.
Somebody has their mic open, I think.
I muted them.
Okay. Jim, do you have something to report?
Yeah. I attended several meetings, one that I've been to now a couple times is the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. They have monthly meetings, and because they're rolling out draft materials for the 8th power plan that affects, tells us, we pay for this information through our rates up to BPA, and BPA funds their council. And so they're a valuable source in terms of what our energy outlook is going to be, like resource adequacy and loss of load probability. So anyway, the meeting they had week before last with the council, they were discussing the output from the power committees. And this material was also presented at WAPUTA at the energy subcommittee that I was participating in. And so I'll basically cover both. Now, the reporter from WAPUTA was actually in the subcommittee dealing with this. And what I listened to was a report out by a committee to the council members. And one of the things they were doing is taking these various models, like the flow models and generation model called Aurora, how that feeds information into Genesis, and then how that feeds information into a resource strategy. And what they're after is trying to figure out what does it take to meet the 5% loss of load probability. And that 5% is seen as the industry standard in terms of you don't want to be above loss of load greater than 5%. And one of the things that people need to realize, a lot of people believe that this percentage means the percent of the odds of percentage that you're going to have a blackout, and that's not what that means. It basically means you're going to be in a situation where you're short on resources and you have to do something unusual. You might call it an emergency, and a lot of time these issues are a matter of a minute or two. Sometimes they could be hours, and so loss of load probability is really just a metric to figure out how your system is responding. But of course they leave out, we have, when a BPA line goes down out here because of trees and we lose power for 3 days, that's considered one event. And so you see that it's kind of it's not a good way to determine, where you should actually put your money in terms of the transmission system or whatnot, but it does help you understand, how your resources are piling up. Anyway, so they ran these models called Genesis, and they put in, and they basically updated Genesis to give us, and they, you know, did some improvements to it. And I think to their surprise, what they're finding now is that the models are showing that instead of what we've been hearing, that the loss of load probability was going to increase continuously over time, over the next 10 years because of coal replacements or closures and things like that and demand increases, what we're actually seeing is within 2 or 3 years, we will be seeing a drop below 5%, or, you know, it'll drop, start dropping below 5% pretty quickly and be down to 2% about 5 years from now. This was a pretty big surprise to the council and everybody listening, because they hadn't been expecting that because of all the, and this was mentioned before when we were talking about the Snake River dams, is all this discussion about resource adequacy and that we're short of resources, when it looks like the opposite is true. And what we're, and the reason what's driving that, of course, is the amount of solar in California and other renewables within reach of the, you know, in the Northwest or in the Northwest, is basically the model is showing that these resources are cheaper, and so it's all, it's showing that that's the best way to go. Now, this is a little disturbing if you happen to be a an owner of a gas-fired plant or a coal plant, and one of the commissioners, you know, pointed out that if what you're telling us about, you know, like right now, as we speak, we're having negative prices on power leaving, hydropower leaving the grid and going to California. This is going to be much more the case and more common, not just in the springtime, but in the summer and the fall and other times, and even the winter at times. And so what we're seeing is this rapid decrease in renewable resources, including battery. And, you know, I know everybody talks about, you know, wind, solar's no good at night and all that kind of stuff, but a lot of solar, 2,600 megawatts of solar with battery has been added to the interconnection queue at BPA just in the last 5 months. So you've got all these vectors coming in here that are basically showing us that we're going to have a lot of power, and the trick is, what do we do with it? Because as if you understand our hydro system with so many run-of-river dams in it, you can't just turn these dams off. You have to do something with that power. And so we're going to see a lot more negative pricing. And that means not only solar coming up here, but hydro going the other way. So it's like, what does all this mean? So I think it's really important for PUDs to really pay attention to what's going on now with these updates in terms of what they're beginning to tell us now. And it actually should be no real surprise of anybody that's been looking at the price of solar, batteries, wind, et cetera, over the last 7 or 8 years and the way they've been dropping down, keeping in mind that hydro is not going to get cheaper. It's going to get more expensive over time because of the loss of industrial base on an aging technology. So anyway, that was and I guess the point I was going to make, one of the counselors pointed out that this could end up idling gas plants for long periods of time, and yeah, as staff said, that's potentially the case. That also begs the question, though: what happens if we've got too much hydropower? What do you do with this? This hydropower that you have to pay somebody to get rid of it a lot more often than we're doing now. So I think that's something we really are going to have to pay attention to, and I think that's why, you know, these discussions we had a couple hours ago about Snake River dams are, you know, I think we're barking up the wrong tree here by saying we want to lock ourselves in to hydro projects, at least all of them. Some of them are going to be critical. The storage dams are critical in this analysis if we're looking forward, because they become one of the batteries of a lot of renewables. Okay, so on to, they also gave a presentation on fish and wildlife in terms of salmon returns, projected salmon returns on the snake this coming year. And the and that presentation basically indicated that we're about going to be in a couple runs will be a little bit better, A couple runs will be worse than last year, so basically about the same as 2020 in terms of salmon returns on the lower Snake, and which is not good news because that's what we're talking about is 50% below the 10-year average, and that's been now for 5 or 6 years. So that's not any sign of recovery whatsoever. Let's see. So with the Waputa meeting, we talked a lot about different bills, and these bills are in committees and so forth, going back and forth. So it's really tricky to you know, lay out a bunch of detail here that's probably already changed since I wrote this down. One thing that seemed like it was progressing, it's probably a good news thing, is a bill that would change or give us a way of crediting our B&O taxes to help support COVID-related rearages. Rearages in the state, that's people that can't pay their bills so far because of COVID, because of the moratorium, we're now approaching or are at about $200 million. So it's an amount of money that is pretty significant. And I guess, Sean, it'd be good if we maybe had an update at the next meeting about where we stand on rearages within the RPUD.
I can give you just a quick update if you want, Jim.
Okay, let me finish and you can do that. Okay. Yeah. Or you mean next time? Or
I can just, yeah, whatever you prefer.
Okay, let me wrap it up and that would be good to hear. So I'm not going to go into detail about all the different bills and so forth. And let me see if I had anything else relative to Waputa or I guess not. So what is there a quick update you can tell us on rearages?
Yeah, just real quick. We currently have about 1,500 accounts that are in arrears. The most concerning ones are the ones that get to 90 days and beyond. And of those 1,500, about 325 of those are in that column. And since the beginning of the pandemic, I'm calling it April 1st for arrearage tracking. Our 90-day arrears dollars have gone up 5,000%. So when the pandemic started, we had $3,300 in 90-day arrears, and as of this morning, there was $168,000 in the 90-day column. So that's just a quick update.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
You bet.
That's all I have, Will.
Thank you, Jim. Sean, is that those number of accounts that in arrears, we were asking to commit to some type of a true-up, some kind of phased-in true-up of those accounts. How many people have agreed to do that?
I don't have that figure off the top of my head. You know, the real problem is that customers that we entered into a payment plan with them early on, so last summer, for example, when they missed their payment, we would contact them and say, you know, hey, you missed your payment. This is a plan that you agreed to. And they would say, well, yeah, but nothing's going to happen, so I'm just not going to pay you. The utility, unfortunately, doesn't really have any way to force a customer at this time to pay their bill. And so when the word got out that, you know, you don't have to pay your bill, then that's what some customers have chosen to do.
Yeah, no surprise there, I think. Okay, good. Thank you. Well, let's see. What did I do? I'll go into Energy Northwest first. I'm on the CEO selection committee. We had a couple of meetings, virtual meetings, of course. We'll put our recommendations forward to the executive board on Tuesday, tomorrow, actually. And what we're looking at is going external, posting the job, sending out posting to see if there are external candidates, highly qualified, that would meet the requirements. The real issue there is that Energy Northwest has become one of the front runners as far as the nuclear industry is concerned. They're top performer. They've got these agreements with X Energy and TerraPower for small modular reactors. So the conclusion is it'd be a very attractive place to be for some highly qualified people. But having said that, we're going into a high degree of change here with, of course, we're losing our CEO. We're losing the chairman of the executive committee. We're looking at the replacement on the executive committee that will be voted on by the board of directors. Interesting that one of those applicants is Janet, and I can't remember her last name, but she was the former COO of Bonneville. And there's another gentleman who was a CEO of Air Liquide, which is a French company, actually. But anyway, it looks like we can attract some pretty good external candidates. But having said that, since we're going into a refueling outage, and we're going through this change period, the recommendation will be that we select an internal candidate for as an interim CEO, and also that we put the internal candidates, of which we have some very good qualified people, into the mix as far as they can apply for the job as well. So that's that story. I also attended some of WAPUTA, and I think, Jim, you did a great job of summarizing that. Just one observation on the Conservation Council. I'm on a resource adequacy task force, and we heard that presentation, and there's a little skepticism because what the council is saying is, well, we don't have a problem with resource because we can import renewables from out of state. You mentioned California, but build out is happening elsewhere as well. And then we can back that up with the hydro system. And the thinking is the hydro system flexible enough to actually do that? So there's some concern about that. Then I had a real good time listening to the class on the Public Disclosure Commission. And you have to file online, and they have this little tutorial of how to do that. That thing gets more and more complex every year. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. But anyway. And then went back to WAPUTA and sat through the Energy Committee, and I think you've covered some of that. The legislation that's going through in Olympia, the Conservation Council findings and so on were discussed. So that was a good – we got a good synopsis there on those items. So let's see, what else? That's probably enough. So anyway, we'll move on to staff reports. Do we have any staff reports, Doug? John,
let me get myself unmuted here, Will. I'm sorry.
Okay.
No staff reports today.
Okay. Action items. T, did we capture any action items?
There were no recorded action items, Will.
You're muted, Will. You're muted, Will. There you go.
Okay, sorry. I'm in good company. Everybody does it. Okay, what did I say? Let's go move on to public comments. And
yeah.
We'll see. Sean, did we have?
Yeah, Christine Reed asked to make a comment, and then if anybody else would like to make a comment, go ahead and send me your name in chat now, please.
Okay, let's do the same timer thing and conduct it like that. We committed to do that earlier, so.
I lost the timer thing, Will, due to technical difficulties, so I will just time it here locally.
Okay, good. Thank you.
That's okay. I promise to be quick. Yeah.
Go ahead, Christine.
Okay, I promise to be quick. My question is regarding the resolution 2194-2. Since it is founded on the EIS and the ESA, when the EIS is overturned, will we be able to go back and revisit the resolution, or are we just stuck with it on something that actually will be moot in the future? Those EISs, five of them have already been overturned. And I was just wondering if it is overturned, if that would rescind that resolution in its entirety or if we would have to revisit it. And secondly, because we're not allowed to ask questions or have discussions during the board meetings, which is fine, but previously we were able to have a public discussion and in the meetings when we met at the office there. And I was wondering if we could maybe do that via Zoom these days, because after listening to all of the information and the comments that people make, there's a lot of discussion. We need to actually be discussing the current data and the current resources and the current studies that have been done on anything that has to deal with the Pacific Northwest ecosystem. And we allowed this kind of time for 5G when we had the issues with 5G and the people were concerned about that. The community was very concerned about that. And we also did it with net metering. And there are many of us in the that are ratepayers and live here in the community that do not agree with this resolution and do not actually like the idea that we're bound to it. So that's that. And thank you, Commissioner Pascal and or Purser and Waddell for your excellent reports.
Yeah,
and hopefully Rick will be able to start giving us reports in the future. We're looking forward to hearing some reports from your meetings.
Yeah, I think the 5G issue was with the county. We didn't really get into that.
Yeah, but we had the meetings at the building there. We were able to use the facility.
Oh, yeah, building, but
yeah.
It wasn't.
And this actually is a PUD issue, so it would be nice if we could have open discussion. The information that Jim brings, and maybe everybody may not agree with it, but that's not the point. The point is that we need the current data. We need current information, not what happened 30 years ago, you know. So that's my comment.
Thank you. Who's next, Sean?
Brian Grad.
Thank you. I have a suggestion regarding the earned or the energy assistance needs of customers. You know, like when you go to the market, there's usually a little button that says, would you like to contribute, you know, $1, $5, $20, whatever, to a particular cause. It seems like every business has an opportunity to do that. So I don't think it would be too hard to include something like that, maybe on the bill for people or an online option if they pay their bills online. And it could possibly help the PUD manage these costs better. I'd like to revisit the resolution and just note that I agree with Christine that the situation in the Columbia River power generation scheme is changing. We have cheaper renewable resources that are available now to replace any energy loss on those dams. And in fact, in the drier seasons, since they're run-of-the-river dams, the power generation is way down, and I don't see why we couldn't use renewables to bring that up to speed. And if you're going to do that, then you've already proven that that's a moot point. You guys got in a car a little too early, I think, and you're heading down the road. I just highly suggest you tighten your seat belts or you put your seat belts on to make sure that when you run into an obstacle, like a favorable response to the Simpson plan and it gains momentum, it's going to look kind of silly that we went ahead and did this without really reviewing all of the data as Christine recommends. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Brian.
Sean.
I'm sorry, Sean, anybody else?
No other commenters.
Okay, good. All right, so we do not have an executive session, so there's no other business to come before the commission. We stand adjourned. Thank you for participating. Good comments, all.